This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years with the arrival of Anniversary Blend Coffee and Tea. Portland locations on the web at PETS.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Locals living near the Trojan nuclear plant plan big parties for next Sunday's planned demolition of the cooling tower. But is that waterfront picnic really a good idea?
Texas residents speak out against troops at the border.
The Pentagon releases more video of the 9/11 attacks.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,450 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 39,344 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true Iraq body count may be as high as 250,000 dead.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 16th, 2006. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Josonia Watson. The Associated Press is reporting today that the Oregon primary campaigners have done everything short of begging to get voters to cast their ballots in today's election. Nevertheless, state officials show only 23% of voters had cast their votes as of yesterday. That's better turnout than many other states can muster up in a primary, but it's not as high a turnout as Oregon has reached in the past. Metro area voting is lower in the rural counties. Election officials say turnout numbers could be down because there's no hot statewide ballot measure or U.S. Senate race on the ballot. If you haven't voted yet, drop-off sites are located at public libraries throughout the Willamette Valley and the Columbia Gorge. Most close at 6 p.m. in Clark County. Washington drop-off boxes are open until 8 p.m. Call ahead or find out more on the web. County election offices throughout the region are open until 8 p.m.
The Corvallis City Council unanimously approved a 5% tax on telecommunications that includes cell phones. The tax takes effect July 1st. It will raise $700,000 a year for fire protection, council members said. Cell phone companies opposed being included in the tax and said they would try to get it referred to voters. City Council member Scott Zembrick said the city has a responsibility to find money to pay for essential services. Council members said a campaign by the industry that included direct mail, telephone banks, and newspaper ads didn't result in much opposition from residents. Former council member Tony Howell said one of the half a dozen people who spoke in favor of the tax, he said it would probably lead to lower fire insurance rates that would more than offset the cost of the tax for many residents. Stacy Sprinkle of Verizon Wireless said it was unfair to target telecommunication companies and requests to consider a business tax were ignored.
Salem Kaiser School Superintendent Kay Barker plans next year to fully revamp the way the district teaches bilingual students. While the superintendent had mentioned the plan before, this is the first time she pleaded to pay for it. The estimated cost is nearly $500,000. Under the proposal, Baker announced Monday night a three-year implementation plan would be put in place next school year. Baker made this last-minute pitch to the district citizen budget committee on Monday after explaining that the district will receive about $3.3 million more from the state of Oregon than had been expected. Most of the money will come from the so-called May adjustment, when the state adjusts its payment to districts for the previous two school years to reflect actual enrollment. Baker told the committee that the State Department of the Education requires the bilingual program to be started by fall.
Next Sunday, May 21st at 7 a.m., PGE plans to blow up the main cooling tower of the mothballed Trojan nuclear plant. The blast is expected to last 8 seconds, but the Trojan story has lasted for years, and it's not over yet. All this week, the KBOO News presents a retrospective on the ill-fated plant. Tonight, KBOO's Stephanie Potter explores the many viewing parties scheduled for the Trojan plant's periphery next Sunday morning, and the question of whether getting close is really a good idea.
Parties and celebrations have been planned to view the dynamite explosion that will take down the Trojan nuclear power plant early this Sunday. On their website, the Cacophony Society has promised a disco bus that will take you to the Trojan cooling tower to experience the implosion at a secret viewing location. Guests are asked to dress in their radioactive finery. The Longview Daily News reports that residents are charging money for people to party at their houses. Betsy Polito, the director of tourism for the St. Helens Capoose Chamber of Commerce, says they have arranged for jet boat excursions as part of a promotion welcoming sightseers to their community.
If you don't have your own boating transportation to go watch the implosion, we are doing packages on the river and in the process of actually getting a second boat because we sold out all of our tickets on our packages.
The jet boats will be getting as close as the Coast Guard allows.
The river mile markers 70 through 75 are closed down by the Coast Guard. Our boats are going to mile marker 75 in the Martin Slough area. It's about 2.5 to 3 miles away, so you can see approximately 85 to 90% of the tower.
Polito is convinced that the tourists will be out of harm's way.
I've been reading the facts on the PGE website, and from my understanding from reading that information, there shouldn't be an issue. It sounds like it's been marked radiation-free since May of 2005, which is why they are able to go through forward with the implosion. So, and we are making sure that we keep our guests at a safe enough distance from the implosion site. We're following all of the U.S. Coast Guard regulations, so I'm not concerned about safety.
Others aren't so sure.
That's pretty stupid. I'm sorry. I think it's something that should be definitely video, you know, captured on film and made available to people as a very positive image of the passage of this potentially catastrophic facility from the faith of the Northwest that would be celebrated. However, it should be done, you know, with remote imaging and shared on film. I really think it's a mistake for people to turn out and potentially get covered with that powder and dust.
That was Mary Olson, director of the Southeast Office of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service based in Ashland, North Carolina. Her concern is about the dust that could be released by the implosion.
It's well known that the radioactivity of a reactor is sufficient to activate the concrete of cooling towers. They may also be contaminated, which is a different issue, but simply the proximity to the amount of radiation activates the concrete. And so that material, even if they claim, oh, it never got contaminated, is radioactive. And as they implode, as in any explosion, you're going to be creating dust and small particles. There's no way that's all going to be contained on site.
She said the risk could be local or wide-ranging.
One of the bigger concerns is either in the immediate area where the particulate can travel close by, or if enough of it gets lofted into the atmosphere, then it may be a community hundreds of miles away that completely unknowingly gets a certain amount of it in radioactive fallout in rain. And I am pretty consciously advising parents of young children today in the United States that live in this region anyway, where we have 33 large nuclear reactors online and they want to add 15 more. When their kids play out in the rain, they should come in and have a shower or a bath afterwards.
Her advice is to exercise caution.
Every radiation exposure carries a risk. All of those risks add up over our lifetime. As Dr. Helen Caldicott says, all it takes is one cell and one radioactive emission to create the possibility of cancer. Now, certainly not every radiation exposure causes cancer, but every radiation exposure increases our risk of getting either fatal or non-fatal cancer, and other health effects are now being linked to radiation as well.
For Olson, another big risk is the site itself.
Nearly every operator has buried so-called low-level waste on the site, and yet low-level waste has radioactive elements in it that will be radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years. There's a lot of controversy about the release of those sites ever for the use of any other purpose. They may well be under permanent control. You know, when you think about it, we're essentially leaving a full toilet for the future generations.
Olson had this to say about the possibility of more nuclear plant implosions.
Well, quite frankly, if we were getting rid of nuclear plants, I would worry about this. The sad thing is that the Congress decided to give $14 billion for building new nuclear plants. So I'm a lot more worried about the new nuclear plants at the moment. If we had a lot of reactors to implode, I'd be celebrating.
Mary Olson of the Nuclear Information and Resource Center, that was founded 28 years ago in opposition to new nuclear reactors and nuclear waste dumps. Meanwhile, Beth Polito with the St. Helens Scappoose Chamber of Commerce sees things looking up for her region.
I haven't been here for the entire history of the nuclear power plant, but I have heard some folks say, well, it's coming down. There's a lot more growth out in Columbia County because there's less of a stigma attached to it now. I think that it's going to just help increase our desirability of our area.
Merchants in St. Helens are extending their hours for the implosion, and restaurants are participating in discounts. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
The high cost of fossil fuel might put a crimp in one of Oregon Town's flag-waving Memorial Day traditions. Traditionally, on that weekend, the American Legion and LeGrand and other groups place more than 200 flags along the pathway at the Grand View Cemetery, forming the Avenue of Flags. At night, they use diesel fuel to generate electricity to shine near the lights. Business and institutions donate goods and services, but the sponsors could use help with the money. American Legion officials say it wasn't bad when diesel cost $1.75 a gallon, but now that it costs more than $3 a gallon, they need help. Maybe they should use biodiesel.
Grants County officials are reporting a sharp rise in the number of outsiders traveling there to kill themselves. Grant County in eastern Oregon has fewer than 8,000 permanent residents, but had several suicides there in 2005 and three in 2004. Snow still covers the road where many traveled to commit suicide, so there may be more to discover. It has the highest suicide rate per capita in the state. Grants County Sheriff Glenn Palmer says people typically come there because they remember happier times spent in the country when return to the isolated area in a bout of depression or trouble.
School nurses at Ellsworth Elementary in Vancouver sent more than 40 children home this morning after the students reported recent bouts of vomiting or diarrhea. This morning's screening was part of their effort to prevent the spread of norovirus symptoms that sickened a quarter of the school's enrollment Monday, when about 120 students were absent or left during the day. The symptoms, consistent with the virus suspected in similar outbreaks at three local senior care centers, also took a toll on the school's faculty. 14 of Ellsworth's 28 teachers were not able to make it to work Tuesday and were replaced by substitutes.
The Pentagon today released the first video images of American Airlines Flight 77 crashing into the military headquarters building on September 11, 2001. The attack killed 189 people. The images recorded by Pentagon security cameras outside the building were made public in response to a December 2004 Freedom of Information Act request by Judicial Watch, a public interest group. Some still images from the video had previously been leaked and publicly circulated, but this was the first official release. Already an argument is brewing about what the video shows. Officials and many media say the airplane is a thin white blur on the video as it slams into the Pentagon at ground level. Almost instantly, a white flash and a huge orange fireball appears on the video, followed by a tower of gray-black smoke. Others argue that the airplane looks more like a missile. Deborah Burlingame, whose brother Charles was the pilot of the American Airlines plane, said in a telephone interview that she realized Pentagon officials were compelled to release the videos under the Freedom of Information Act. But she says the images provide no new information about what happened that day.
After years of secrecy, the Pentagon has finally disclosed the names, ages, and home countries of everyone held at the isolated Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in southeastern Cuba as suspects in the U.S.-led war on terror. None of the most notorious terrorist suspects was included in the list, raising questions about their whereabouts. The U.S. says it has held 759 males, ranging from teenagers to older than 70, from more than 40 countries, according to the list released late Monday in response to a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by the Associated Press. The list includes some 200 previously undisclosed names. There are of former Guantanamo detainees who were moved out before the military began hearings in the summer of 2004 to determine whether detainees were properly classified as enemy combatants. While the list includes the 10 detainees who had been charged with crimes, it doesn't include alleged September 11th plotters. Lawyers and other advocates will be able to use the new list to track who has been held at the base and find former detainees to help investigate allegations of abuse.
The White House is going to let more senators know about its terrorist surveillance program. Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Pat Roberts says the president has agreed to allow every member of the committee to be briefed. Senators from both parties have been calling for such a move, saying it wasn't enough to brief just a handful of senators. The briefing will take place Wednesday, a day before General Michael Hayden's confirmation hearing to be the new head of the CIA. The announcement came a few hours after the president insisted the U.S. does not listen in on domestic telephone conversations among ordinary Americans. But he wouldn't specifically discuss the allegations that the government has been compiling records of phone calls and whether that is an invasion of privacy.
Common Dreams reports today that one of the key lawsuits against secret government wiretapping was dropped over the weekend. Early Saturday morning, the United States government filed a motion to dismiss the Electronic Frontier Foundation's class action lawsuit against AT&T for illegally handing over its customers' telephone and internet records and communication to the National Security Agency. The government claims that its legal brief and two affidavits from senior intelligence officials that accompanied the motion are classified, preventing even the parties to the lawsuit, the foundation, and AT&T from seeing them. While the government's entire brief was kept secret and a censored version made publicly available, the government said that the case against AT&T should be immediately terminated because any judicial inquiry into the whether AT&T broke the law could reveal state secrets and harm national security.
And in similar news, the FBI acknowledged late Monday that it is increasing seeking reporters' phone records in leak investigations. The acknowledgement followed reports that ABC News reporters had been warned by a federal source that the government knew who we were calling. In a statement, the FBI press office says its leak investigations begin with the examination of government phone records. The FBI will take logical investigative steps to determine if a criminal act was committed by a government employee by the unauthorized release of classified information, the statement said. Officials say that means that phone records of reporters will be sought if government records are not sufficient. At issue is a Patriot Act provision allowing agents to seek information that what are called national security letters. The NSLs are a version of an administrative subpoena and are not signed by a judge. Under the law, a phone company receiving an NSL for phone records must provide them and may not divulge the customer that the records have been given to the government.
Attorneys for the ACLU have asked the FBI to reveal any post-September 11th surveillances of Southern California Muslims. The ACLU made the request for documents yesterday after Islamic leaders said the FBI gave them little information when they alleged that the investigators had been monitoring local Muslims and mosques. The civil liberties group used the Freedom of Information Act to file the request on behalf of six Islamic organizations and several Muslim individuals. FBI officials said in an email to the LA Times that they would address the ACLU's request but did not mention turning over documents. The assistant director of the Bureau's L.A. office says the FBI does not investigate anyone based on their lawful activities, religious, or political beliefs. The government has 20 days to respond to the ACLU's request under the Freedom of Information Act.
As of Tuesday, May 16, 2006, at least 2,449 members of the U.S. military have died since the beginning of the Iraq War in March of 2003, according to an Associated Press count. The figure includes seven military civilians. At least 1,924 died as a result of hostile action, according to the military's numbers. The AP count is three times higher than the Defense Department's tally, last updated Tuesday at 10 a.m. The British military has reported 111 deaths, Italy 31, Ukraine 18, Poland 17, Bulgaria 13, Spain 11, Slovakia, Denmark 3, El Salvador, Estonia, Netherlands, Thailand, 2 each, and Australia, Hungary, Kazakhstan, Latvia, Romania, 1 each. Since the start of the U.S. military operations in Iraq, 18,088 U.S. service members have been wounded, according to a Defense Department tally.
Code Pink, Women for Peace, took out full-page ads in 8 Iraqi newspapers today, calling on Americans and Iraqis to come together to end the occupation of Iraq. 2 major newspapers, Aziman and the U.S.-supported Az Sabah, refused to run the ad. The ad says, "We have seen in poll after poll that the majority of Americans and Iraqis want the U.S. troops to return home. Even the majority of U.S. troops, 72%, think they should return by the end of this year. It is time for the politicians in both countries to listen to us, the people." The ad is linked to a website in Arabic where the Iraqis can sign a petition and communicate directly with the Americans, either by internet or through the mail. To view the website, go to www.estekall.org. Madia Benjamin, co-founder of CoPink, said, quote, "The newspapers are reporting that they are swamped with calls from readers saying that the ad gives them hope and makes them realize that there are Americans who support their desire to be free from foreign occupation. We must find ways to work together to end the bloodshed." The ads are paid for by hundreds of Code Pink supporters from around the United States.
And now, live from death row, commentary by Momia Abu-Jamal.
When I first came to prison, a journalist friend's wife sent me a packet of novels by a writer I never heard of. The writer was Octavia E. Butler, and the books were titled Mind of My Mind, Kindred, and Wild Seed. I read them with greedy delight, and the characters, black, body-changing, and shape-shifting immortals who walked through centuries the way we walk through doors, embedded themselves so deeply in mind that I dreamt of them for days thereafter. The feral, somewhat cynical Doro, a being who moved from soul to soul, with memories as ancient as the pyramids, and knew everything but death. The sensitive, loving Anyanwu, a being who lived first in Nigeria, but shifted shape when survival or curiosity demanded it, and who traveled the dreaded Middle Passage from Africa to America, and lived as man, as woman, as crone, as bird, or dolphin, who tasted life as various entities for 300 years lived in her work. From that day to this, I've read every book by Octavia E. Butler that I could get my hands on, and never felt anything less than amazement and wonder at page's end. Some say Octavia E. Butler was an anomaly in the genre known as science fiction, or sci-fi for short, given her blackness and her womanness. And while it made her a living, it's only fair to say that she gave far more to the genre than it returned. As a reader of sci-fi since I was a boy, I became quietly troubled by the monochromatic nature of the visions created by writers in the field. It was almost as if, in crafting ideal futures, those tomorrows were meant to be white. Octavia E. Butler utterly shattered those visions, and half a dozen more, perhaps forever. I'm told that she rebelled at the label genius, but she was that and more. Octavia Estelle Butler, 1947-2006. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
After more than 14 weeks and 54 government and defense witnesses, the Enron trial is almost over. It is considered the biggest fraud case in a generation. Jurors will hear from the defense today and begin deliberations tomorrow after getting the last word from prosecutors in the case. The federal prosecutor said yesterday that Enron Corporation founder Kenneth Lay inadvertently showed the top-down view that he and former chief executive Jeffrey Skilling were immune to rules that govern others during his contentious testimony in the Paris fraud and conspiracy trial. In the government's closing argument, capped the biggest fraud case to emerge from the scandalous Enron error. Prosecutors Catherine Ruhlmer on Monday displayed for jurors what she called telling a quote from Lay. "Rules are important, but they should not, you should not, be a slave to their rules either."
The government's newest cooperating witness in the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal, a former congressional aide to Ohio Republican Representative Bob Ney, will testify at the trial of the former top procurement official in the Bush administration. David Safian, the ex-chief of the staff of the General Services Administrator Office, is accused of concealing from GSA investigators and a Senate committee his involvement with Abramoff's efforts to acquire GSA-controlled property. Neil Volz, Ney's former chief of staff, pleaded guilty last week in the investigation of influence peddling by Abramoff on Capitol Hill, the Interior Department, and at the General Services Administration where Safavian worked.
Elderly and disabled people who miss the deadline for enrolling in the new Medicare drug benefit would not pay a financial penalty if they try to sign up later this year. That's under legislation that Senate sponsors predict will gain swift and overwhelming approval. The deadline for signing up for Medicare drug coverage this year ended at midnight on Monday. Now that the first open enrollment period for drug benefit has expired, beneficiaries, with the exception of low-income people eligible for extra help, currently cannot enroll in a plan until November 15th at the earliest. Once their coverage began next January 1, they would have to pay higher monthly premiums as a penalty for not enrolling earlier. The penalty equals 1% of the national average premium for each month of delay, or an additional fee of about $2.50 per month. After 43 million Medicare beneficiaries are eligible to enroll in a private insurance plan that would subsidize a portion of their medicine expenses. Overall, there are an estimated 6 million plus beneficiaries without coverage.
While women have long been manipulating hormonal contraception to skip on block or block menstrual periods, a new pharmaceutical product is being introduced this week to do the same thing. Yet with some of the anti-bleeding pills, it's hard to say whether they're meant as birth control or convenience products for young women who can't be bothered with menstruation. This new market is called menstrual suppression. The first, called Seasonal, went onto the market 3 years ago. Described as a standard birth control pill taken for 84 days, followed by a week off for withdrawal bleeding, its sales and new prescriptions have been rising quickly. Seasonique, a successor to Seasonal, is expected to reduce breakthrough bleeding and hormonal fluctuations even more. It, unlike RU-487, is expected to get federal approval at week's end. Also on the market are Libral, the first daily birth control pill designed to be taken indefinitely. Implanon, a one-rod, three-year contraception implanted in the upper arm that stops menstruation in many women, has yet to be approved by the FDA.
A drug maker says the federal government has approved a new pill for cancer patients that includes a man-made version of the active ingredient in marijuana. The medication for chemotherapy patients was taken off the U.S. market 17 years ago. But Valiant Pharmaceuticals says it hopes to return the prescription drug to the pharmacies within a few weeks. The drug is designed to ease the vomiting and nausea that often follow chemo treatment. Valiant brought the formula from L. Lilly in 2004. The new medication will compete with a Belgian-made drug that also includes synthetic THC.
Native leaders are at the U.S. Capitol today calling for a national outcry against the six-year delay in passing the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, which would provide health care for American Indian tribes and Alaska Natives. FSRN's Ingrid Drake has more from D.C.
Speaking of American Indians' health disparities at the U.S. Congress, Jefferson Keel, Lieutenant Governor of the Chickasaw Nation, traveled from Oklahoma to D.C. with other members of the National Congress of American Indians to push for the passage of the Indian Health Care Improvement Act.
No American child should be born into a community where the infant mortality rate is 150% greater than that for other Americans. Once you come to our facilities, you'll be heartsick at just seeing that your fellow Americans are living in these conditions. And the fact is, Congress has failed to pass this act for the past 6 years. The Indian Health Care Improvement Act is designed to unbind and unlock the shackles that bind us to poor, outdated health care systems.
The proposed legislation was a result of a historic coming together of all American Indian tribes, says Sally Smith, chairwoman of the National Indian Health Board.
It has been 14 years since the Indian Health Care Improvement Act was modernized. The American health care system has modernized in many dramatic ways in 14 years. Ours has not. Let me tell you a little bit about our conditions. The travesty in the deplorable health conditions of Native people is knowing that the vast majority of illnesses and deaths from disease could be prevented if additional funding and contemporary programmatic approaches to health care was available to provide a basic level of care enjoyed by most Americans.
One of the reasons the bill has not moved quicker is the lack of political representation of American Indians on the Hill and the public's lack of awareness of health issues in Indian country, says Stacy Bolin, director of the National Indian Health Board.
One of the obstacles perhaps that we face is we're a very small percentage of the population. This problem will not be solved alone, and that's why we're reaching out through this effort as a beginning to other Americans.
Republican Senator John McCain from Arizona is the Senate sponsor of the bill and says he has done all he can to move the legislation out of his Indian Affairs Committee.
The problem is just getting the administration to sign on to any kind of reasonable proposal, and they won't. And they haven't.
Action that we can see you taking anytime soon?
Keep working on it.
While dozens of healthcare organizations have endorsed the legislation, the Bush administration has not sent an administrative letter in support of the bill. The White House did not respond to a request for a comment by airtime. The government has expressed concern the Indian Health Care Improvement Act will increase liability. This is not a valid reason, says Stacy Bolin of the National Indian Health Board.
We have not seen any evidence that American Indians and Alaskan Natives have a track record of suing the federal government for anything related to their health care. We'd like to see the evidence that it is an issue that is specific to attach to Indian people, as opposed to a larger legal issue.
Last week, Alaska Congressman Don Young introduced H.R. 5312, a House version of the act, which will have to move out of committee before coming up for a vote. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake.
More rafters on Colorado River trips through the Grand Canyon have fallen sick from a gastrointestinal illness. National Park Service officials and public health officers are trying to trace possible causes of the illness, which a spokeswoman says now has stricken at least two dozen rafters in the past 2 weeks. Spokesman Maureen Ogletree says most are likely victims of norovirus, a common infection which causes nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, although that has not been confirmed. The illness usually lasts 1 to 2 days. Four rafting companies reported sick passengers on four different trips, with about a third of the passengers falling ill. There are also reports of vacationers pulling out of scheduled trips before launching because they have fallen ill.
Some sheriffs, residents, and immigrant advocates along the nation's southern edge raised doubts Monday about President Bush's plan to send shifts of up to 6,000 National Guardsmen to help stop the flow of illegal immigrants across the Mexican border. While some welcomed the idea, others expressed concern that the troops, especially those returning from tours in Iraq, might shoot first and investigate later. Those people worried about a repeat of the 1997 fatal shooting of an 18-year-old goat herder by Marines on a drug control mission in rural West Texas. Overworked local sheriffs said that if the federal government really wants to help, it could send more money to more deputies, equipment, and training. Sheriff Rick Flores of Webb County, which includes Laredo and receives the spillover of violence from drug-wrecked Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, says the president's plan will not stop illegal immigration. El Paso County Sheriff Leo Samaniego said after Bush's 17-minute speech that he felt slighted by the federal government. And President Bush's proposal to send 6,000 National Guard troops to the border has received positive reaction from many lawmakers in Capitol Hill, although some critique deploying already overloaded troops. Meanwhile, the Senate is debating and voting on amendments that will shape their final immigration bill. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports. We apologize for not having that story. We will try to find it sometime later.
The current time is 34 after, and now time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you were in charge and you wanted to give a helping hand to some deserving people in our society, you might single out school teachers or poverty workers or radio commentators like me. Okay, not me, but even I would be more deserving than the people being singled out by the Bushites in Congress to receive $1 trillion in new tax relief over a 10-year span. Who? The very richest people in America. By rich, I don't mean affluent or comfortable. I mean wallowing in wealth multibillionaires, the richest 1/4 of 1% of American families. These are the heirs to the founders of such giants as Walmart, Gallo Wines, Campbell's Soup, and M&M Candies. In a new report, two watchdog groups have documented a decade-long stealth campaign by 18 of these super-rich families to eliminate the federal estate tax. These 18 families, averaging more than $10 billion each in personal wealth, would net a windfall of $71.7 billion if this deal passes. Since it's hard to generate much public enthusiasm for a Save the Billionaires campaign, the families have kept their selfish campaign anonymous by funding front groups to do their dirty work. They've also spent about $500 million on lobbying firms and some $27 million in campaign funds for key politicians, including George W. With their money, these rich heirs have convinced politicians and the media to portray the estate tax as a crushing burden on the middle class, even family farmers, when in fact, 99.75% of Americans pay zero estate taxes. Indeed, when asked to find even one family forced to sell its farm because of this tax, the rich man's front group could not produce a single example. This is Jim Hightower saying, to get the report and help fight for tax fairness, call Public Citizen, 202-588-1000. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
Now here's that story we promised earlier on the Mexican border.
In the president's address, he restated that a guest worker program must be paired with border security. He will send 6,000 National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexico border beginning in June. They will assist with surveillance, analyzing intelligence, building physical and technological fences, and training border patrol agents. It would also encompass local law enforcement to share information with Border Patrol and the Department of Homeland Security. It would do away with the catch-and-release policy and instead return the immigrant to their home country. And finally, it will create a government-issued ID card for immigrants.
The United States must secure its borders. This is a basic responsibility of a sovereign nation. It is also an urgent requirement of our national security. Our objective is straightforward. The border should be open to trade and lawful immigration, and shut to illegal immigrants, as well as criminals, drug dealers, and terrorists.
The Department of Homeland Security will begin implementing this program as early as June. Responding to concerns that the National Guard might be stretched too thin to patrol the border, Lieutenant General Bloom of the National Guard says that they are prepared and ready for the task.
There are three glass balls we have to manage or juggle. One is the war on terrorism. One is response to natural disasters and terrorist events here at home. And we can certainly do what is being asked by our commander-in-chief.
But immigrant rights groups say this is a militarization of the border. Jamie Contreras is a director of the National Capital Immigration Coalition.
I guess my question to him will be, what does it say to the people who are immigrants who are currently serving in the military, who find themselves, some, there are reports that some immigrants come from Iraq to find some of their family members on the deportation lines.
Meanwhile, in the second day of debate in the Senate on Hagel-Martinez, the immigration bill that would divide immigrants into one of three categories depending upon the amount of time they have resided in the U.S., both Republicans and Democrats endorsed the president's plan to send troops to the border. Ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy from Vermont.
I thought his speech last night was a good one. In fact, I think what his problem is going to be more with his own party, which is just splintered.
Democratic leader Harry Reid has criticized the president for not doing enough to convince his fellow party members to support a comprehensive bill. Majority Leader Bill Frist says he supports reform that includes a path to legalization.
The most important part, in my mind, of the overall comprehensive reform. At the same time, we have to have comprehensive reform, because no matter how much effort, how much money, how big a wall you put on the border, it's not going to work unless you have comprehensive reform.
But Senator Frist has been unable to convince his caucus to support that reform. Furthermore, Leader Frist supported an amendment today that goes against comprehensive reform. The provision would halt all legalization programs for immigrants until the president has confirmed that the border is closed and secure. This amendment failed 55-40, but it was the first test on the possible outcome of Hagel-Martinez. If it were to have passed, it would have looked like Hagel-Martinez would not have included comprehensive reform. The next crucial amendments to be voted on would strip the guest worker program and another that would gut the entire legislation except for border security provisions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And in more news regarding the southern frontera, Mexico warned Tuesday it would file lawsuits in U.S. courts if National Guard troops detained migrants on the border, and some officials said they fear the crackdown will force illegal crossers into more perilous areas to avoid detection. Mexican officials worry the crackdown will lead to immigrant deaths. Since the U.S. toughened security at crossing spots in Texas and California in 1994, immigrants have flooded Arizona's hard-to-patrol desert and deaths have increased. Immigrant support groups estimate 500 people died trying to cross the border in 2005. The Border Patrol reported 473 deaths as of September 30th.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear the Progressive Magazine editor Matthew Rothschild interviewing George Takei. That's Mr. Sulu of Star Trek fame, who now works with the Human Rights Campaign to combat the right wing's push against gay marriage. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Amanda's Jam. Weather, yesterday, heat wave broke records throughout the region with highs in the mid-90s. In the Willamette Valley, today's high reached the mid-80s and are set to slowly cool off to the mid-70s by the end of the week. In Hood River, it was in the mid-90s today, but cooling to the mid-70s by Friday, low 70s through the weekend. You are listening to KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
In Congress today, senators struck a deal today that they said would make coal mining safer, requiring more emergency oxygen supplies and better monitoring in reaction to the Sago mine disaster that killed 12 miners in West Virginia in January. A hearing was set for Wednesday on the legislation, which would require miners to have at least 2 hours of oxygen available instead of one as under the current policy. It would also require mine operators to store extra oxygen packs along escape routes. The proposal would require that any emergency air supplies stashed in mines be monitored for reliability. Randall McCloy, Jr., the only miner who survived at Sago, has said that at least four of the miners' air packs did not work, forcing the men to share. One man was killed in the blast, and 11 others died when carbon monoxide poisoning entered the mine.
The government won't be ready for another major disaster such as Hurricane Katrina unless the Pentagon takes a more aggressive role in the federal response, congressional investigators said yesterday. Poor planning and confusion about the military's role contributed to the problem after the storm struck on August 29, 2005, and without immediate attention, improvement is unlikely, the Government Accountability Office said. It urged the Defense Department to establish procedures to speed aircraft, troops, and reconnaissance gear to hurricane-stricken areas when local and state officials are overwhelmed, as well as beef up communication support to Homeland Security officials, who have the lead role in a disaster. Responding to the study, Assistant Defense Secretary Paul McHale said that the Pentagon has taken several steps to improve its disaster response. In recent weeks, defense officials have stocked up on cellular and satellite phone vans, begun updating their emergency response plans, and have placed the special trained military personnel into the Federal Emergency Management Agency regional offices.
In Brazil, the situation in the streets of Sao Paulo is much calmer today after 4 days of intense violence. Natalia Viana reports.
Panic spread through the city yesterday due to false stories that the first command of the capital, criminal gang, or PCC in Portuguese, would next target shopping centers and schools. The stores shut their doors, schools released their students and 60% of the bus lines stopped. The streets were completely empty last night in São Paulo. The police insists the situation now is under control. All the prison rebellions have ceased yesterday. Some sources say due to an agreement between the government and the leaders of the PCC. Police hunted suspects in the streets of São Paulo last night. Since Friday, 91 people have been arrested and 38 suspects have been killed, more than the number of police officers killed by the criminals, which was 31. Some sources told FSRN that many civilians were shouted at, threatened, and even punched by the police officers who were patrolling the city outskirts over the weekend. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Natalia Viana in São Paulo, Brazil.
Figures on carbon dioxide emissions just released by the European Commission show that pollution by big corporations may be rendering other environmental efforts almost worthless. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The figures are disappointing. In Britain alone, five companies are producing more carbon dioxide pollution together than all the motorists on UK roads combined. Campaigners say it means that until and unless there is the real political will to impose tighter restrictions on industry, efforts by individuals and households to cut their carbon footprints will make little difference. Worse still, the carbon trading scheme that was intended to reduce global emissions may be making things worse. The scheme's supposed to work using market forces. Companies failing to hit an emissions target must buy permits to pollute from companies that have successfully cut emissions. However, the evidence so far is that European companies were granted too many permits. That means there are large shortfalls. Those costs will be passed on to customers in higher bills. And the pressure's now on to reform Europe's carbon emissions trading scheme. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
UN Habitat says three-quarters of people in African urban areas still live in slums and informal settlements. The number of people living in urban areas grew from approximately 172 million in 1994 to 264 million in 2004, leading to overcrowding and poor sanitation. The UN says the African private sector has the capital to invest in housing and basic services, but lacks in incentives.
Women activists on the African continent are asking their respective governments to bolster campaigns for female condom use. At an annual conference held in Kampala, Uganda, several women delegates were bitter that in most African countries, priority has been given to the male latex condoms, they say ineffectively marketed. The female condom could work miracles in reversing the trend of unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted infections. Emmanuel Okila reports from Uganda, where women say that they want control over their own health and argue that contraceptives are more effective when controlled by the woman.
Women in Africa are demanding greater control on their health. This comes when Uganda, a country considered role model for other African countries for HIV/AIDS prevention due to a 6.4% prevention rate, is battling apathy amongst its population. Despite Uganda's success, there's growing fear that many Ugandans have become relaxed, disregarding protective measures and believing that AIDS is history. In response, women activists in Uganda are demanding that the government continues to promote its awareness campaigns with the addition of female condom use. Dr. Margaret Muganwa is the vice president of the Society of Women in Africa. She argues that apart from complementing the now widely accepted male latex, the female condom also gives women the right to protection.
Who is at risk today? It is the married woman during the reproductive period and young women in stable relationships. These are the same women who are not able to negotiate the condom. When you ask men, they say, oh, we shall use the condom with a one-off, a person we don't know very well. Where is the epidemic? The epidemic is with the wives and women in stable relations. So you can see that unless we can prevent the infection among the most vulnerable, we are losing the battle. Do women have an option of HIV prevention? No. They are not able to negotiate the male condom. They cannot put on the male condom. The female condom is nowhere to be seen. You can really see that this is a human rights issue.
The female condom is reportedly the only contraceptive controlled by females that protects them from both pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections. Researchers say if perfectly used, the female condom has a failure rate of 5% and can be put 8 hours prior to sex. Sold at about $3 in the open market, the female condom was introduced in Uganda about 3 years ago. Wanting to make it affordable, government subsidized it to less than half a dollar. Marie Stopes International, MSI, an organization charged to market it, says though most women like the device, many discontinued use due to partner resistance and difficulties in insertion and removal. Florence Namayanja, the program's director, says such drawbacks force them to pull out the product.
We really tried all the available marketing strategies, but we had acceptance problems. We even reached a level where we had to advise government to withdraw the female condom simply because it was proven a waste of taxpayers' money. And the problem also arose mainly because the men claimed the condom made sexual activity less enjoyable.
While condoms have increasingly become important as a method to slow sexually transmitted infections, acceptance of the female condom is limited because of several real and perceived drawbacks inherent in the method. The concept, appearance, and use of female condoms are still unfamiliar to most couples. Perhaps attitudes may become more favorable with continued awareness and usage. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
A follow-up campaign by Right for to Information activists and social audits by the people in the western Indian state of Rajasthan is unearthing financial irregularities in the village development funds. The administration is nervous over the findings, which began after the Right to Employment and Right to Information Acts were passed. FSRN's correspondent Binu Alex has more from Dungapur.
I admit there have been discrepancies, but nothing is intentional. If you think I have done large-scale corruption, cut off my head. This is the village council head of Valota, a village in Rajasthan, where a massive campaign for transparency culminated today into a social audit process of the accounts of this village. The people's audit of the money spent by the village council found millions of rupees siphoned off, and they are questioning the village head. He has no answers. Social audit is the inherent part of the linkage between the National Employment Rural Guarantee Act and the Right to Information Act. Both these acts were passed recently by the Indian Parliament. Despite regular and mandatory financial audits, corruption scandals are a common phenomenon in India. The money meant for the people have to be audited by the people.
Social audit is the most easily understood process. That's where we began with it. It's concrete, it's simple, it's tangible, and it's enforceable. So the social audit process will begin a larger democratic debate about accountability and about policy and about participation of people. And the system and the administration also learns that they will now be answerable to any kind of questioning by the people at any level, at any time.
Aruna Roy is a recipient of the Magsaysay Award, valued as the Asian Nobel Prize for Community Leadership and International Understanding. She set up Mazdoor Kisan Shakti Sangathan, an organization that worked for complete transparency in all government funds and dealings. She is one of the lobbyists who pressurized the government to enact employment and information laws. On foot and by road, more than 1,000 volunteers traveled the length and breadth of Dungapur, one of the poorest districts in Rajasthan, to educate people about the benefits of the Employment Guarantee Act and also to cross-check the payment system. They reported large-scale discrepancies where names of various villagers were illegally shown as recipients of wages. Villagers are afraid to question and unable to face the consequences from the powerful officials. Nikhil Day is one of the employment guarantee campaigners.
Those who have been used to making money quietly are now facing the pressure of the entire people organizing and making those demands. So there is conflict inherent in that. And that conflict will continue for some time until it gets established that information is a right that is beginning to be established and that people will have to provide information. They cannot keep hiding it.
These activists have fought hard to get the acts passed, and the entire purpose of the campaign is to see that corruption is not used to decry, discredit and eventually dismantle this hard-won battle. From Dungarpur in Rajasthan, India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
That's the KBU Evening News for Tuesday, May 16th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kbu.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kbu.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our assistant producer is John Delderfield. Special thanks to reporters Spencer Raymond and Stephanie Potter. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Josonia Watson. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBU Morning News. And at 7:30 a.m., hear Barbara Bernstein's host Locus Focus Talk Radio. Her topics will be the result of today's elections and the Bush immigration plan. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with Catherine Albrecht, author of the award-winning Spy Chips, how major corporations and government plan to track your every move with RFID. About advances in implementation of radio frequency identification technology at the consumer level. At 10:30, Andrew will interview Dr. Azam Alwash, director of the Eden Again Project, which works to restore the marshlands of southern Iraq and Iran. And Jay Thiemeyer will review the work of Portland's Aura Chorus and a group of powerful women singing peace. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 16th of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In an effort to bring more national attention to the effects of global warming in the Arctic, Alaska Native organizations filed a Friend of the Court brief in the U.S. Supreme Court Monday. The 30-page brief, filed by trustees for Alaska on behalf of the Alaska Intertribal Council, the Council of Athabascan Tribal Governments, and the Red Oil Network, describes how global warming threatens the lives, traditions, and communities of Alaska Natives.
We hope that the EPA will begin to regulate emissions on this case.
Faith Gemmel is the outreach coordinator of Red Oil Network, which stands for Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands. She says Red Oil joined the state of Massachusetts in 2003 in the first case ever filed to get the EPA to regulate greenhouse emissions. That case is still pending, but Gemmel says the brief filed yesterday will have an even greater impact on the Supreme Court because she believes the court takes Alaska's tribal input seriously when it comes to the issue.
Because we are hit first, hit hardest by global warming. It's a factor. It's real. It's happening to us in our communities, and we are the ones that have expertise from a traditional perspective, from a tribal perspective. And we add that component to the science. We have the traditional ecological knowledge that we bring to the case, and it strengthens the case.
The question that this brief hopes to answer is whether or not the Clean Air Act requires the federal government to regulate pollution that affects climate. That pollution is specifically greenhouse gases from automobiles. Francis Raskin, an attorney for trustees of Alaska, says this is what the petitioners hope the Supreme Court will address.
The United States is the world's largest emitter of the greenhouse gases that cause global warming. We filed this brief in the Supreme Court on behalf of three Alaska Native organizations because Congress and the Bush administration have refused to take any action to reduce this country's emissions. We hope this brief will convince the court to force them to do so.
Raskin says the rate of global warming in the Arctic is twice that of anywhere else in the world. Meanwhile, in Canada, Nunavut's manager of wildlife research says polar bears are becoming the poster species for doomsday prophets of climate change. Dr. Mitch Taylor made the comment in his 12-page document for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's review of the animal's status. The review follows a petition from the Center for Biological Diversity, Greenpeace, and other groups. They want polar bears listed as threatened on the U.S. endangered species list because of climate change development and contaminants. But Taylor says the groups don't have the evidence to prove their case. Patricia Bell of the CBC has details.
Nunavut Tungavik has now joined Inuit Circumpolar Conference and Inuit Taparik Kanatami in denouncing the decision to list polar bears as vulnerable. Raymond Niuchiak is NTI's second vice president. He says Nunavut has one of the best and most regulated co-management systems in the world. He says the World Conservation Union listed polar bears as vulnerable because of changes to its criteria and categories, not because of changes in population size. But satellite images show sea ice coverage in the Arctic has shrunk to record lows. A major report that came out in 2004 predicts that could push polar bears to the brink of extinction if warming in the north continues. Inuit Circumpolar Conference has publicly backed the report called the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment. Still, the president of ICC Canada, Duane Smith, says he doesn't see a contradiction between that position and his organization's view that the international concern about polar bear numbers is too much too soon.
We are concerned with the long-term health and stability of the polar bear populations, but what we're saying is that we don't believe that they're in as immediate danger as what is being perceived by those activist groups.
Smith says he fears a backlash that could try and attack the right of Inuit, guaranteed under land claims agreements, to sustainably hunt polar bears. Patricia Bell, Iqaluit.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.